You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars, and this is episode 305 of the Columbia Calling podcast. This will be the final episode of 2019. We'll be back around the 7th of January 2020 with more great interviewees and interviews held here in Bogota and around the world online, of course, for the Columbia Calling podcast. I've got some great people lined up. It has been a phenomenal year. We've won the award, Best English Language Podcast by the Latin Podcast Awards. Our numbers have skyrocketed. We're routinely getting more than 10,000 downloads per week from the United States, more than 1,000 from Canada, of course, the UK, Colombia, and so on. Australia growing too. So I won't go on talking about our successes this year, just to leave you with the fact that in episode 305, we will be talking to Juliana Cúcaro, who is from Bogotá. She's a science communicator, and she'll be talking to us about some of the environmental issues taking place here in Colombia. And some of you have been in touch about an environmentally themed podcast, so this one is going out for you. Thank you again for being in touch. And now I'll leave you with Adrian Elsimer with the last news report of the year from him, from Columbia Reports, and then we'll be back. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for Christmas Eve 2019. Colombia's Congress approved a controversial tax reform that has fueled protests in the country since last month. The so-called Economic Growth and Job Creation Bill was approved after extraordinarily chaotic sessions that were held before Congress went on recess. Whether the reform will make it through the Constitutional Court is all but certain. Opponents have already announced they would challenge the bill. Several reported irregularities could allow the court to declare the law unconstitutional. Colombia's notoriously ineffective military justice system will investigate the murder of a peaceful protester by police last month. The decision was rejected by the United Nations, which said that human rights violations do not fall under the jurisdiction of this justice system. The murder of the 70-year-old Dylan Cruz intensified anti-government protests that began on November 21. Despite pending lawsuits, police has continued to violently repress peaceful protests and has allegedly continued to carry out unlawful arrests. According to the Committee for Political Prisoners, more than 1,000 protesters were illegally detained. More than 50 journalists who were covering the protests have also been arrested illegally, according to Press Freedom Foundation FLIP. One of the journalists was allegedly tortured. A judge has ordered taxi service Uber to suspend its operations in Colombia. According to the judge, Uber has failed to comply with local tax and labor regulations. The ruling had been requested by the country's Superintendency for Trade and Industry. Nearly half of Colombia's population has said they struggle to afford food, according to Gallup. The pollster said that the number of people who say they have had trouble to feed their families has been growing for 5 years. Food deficiency is the most prevalent among women, said Gallup. 51% of Colombian women said they have not always been able to buy food. That's the end of Columbia Report's last news bulletin of 2019. I hope you enjoy the holidays and the rest of Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
Like
Yes, this is Columbia Calling, segment 3 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia. And yeah, on this episode 305, the final episode of the year, we'll be back on the 7th of January, I think. But my very special guest, she's here in Bogota, and it's always a great pleasure to have a Colombian on the show to talk about something that's very close to their hearts, the specialism in what they work and so on. Her name is Juliana Cucaro. She's here in Bogota too. And she is she's just completed her master's at the University of West of England. That's in Bristol in the UK. She's just completed her master's in science communication out there. And she's on the line, and we're going to talk a little bit about environmental issues, affecting Colombia. There's been a few of you out there who've asked for this this topic to be addressed on the podcast. So this is for you guys out there. Juliana, thank you for agreeing to come on Colombia Calling.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be on your podcast and to be talking about this. I think it's a very important topic for me.
Well, of course, it's, you know, you're defining your life, science communication and so on. So let's talk about you a little bit. I mean, how did you end up at the University of West of England in Bristol, UK? How did a girl from Bogota end up out there in Bristol? That's funny, funny West country accent.
Yes, Bristol. I did my undergrad in biology at Los Andes University, and I had the opportunity to do some research, but I wasn't quite happy with it. I didn't feel like it was the path I wanted to follow, let's say. Mm-hmm. So I tried a few different things like English teaching and so, and I still realized I missed science, and I enjoyed talking about science, and I enjoyed making people excited about science. So I was following IFL Science. I don't know if you know this blog. It's pretty big nowadays, I think. Mm-hmm. It said that the lady who started it studied science communication, and I had never heard these words together. So I looked up some masters and started applying, and so I got a scholarship for UE, which was amazing. And with a little help from my parents, I managed to go there.
Excellent.
And do the master's.
So cool. It was a good experience, I take it.
Yes, it was really good. Everyone in Bristol is really nice. But I don't know if it's like British people are just really nice or really polite. It takes a while to know.
Yeah,
it takes a while to know.
It's a different
but no, it was a good experience. Now I'm just trying to build some more experience and portfolio and trying to get out there. So this is great for me.
Great. So we're part of your portfolio. Well, I'm flattered. Now, listen, it's been a tumultuous few weeks in Colombia, and those of you out there who've been listening, and we've of course done an episode on the protests and the reasons for the protests, but there seem to be, you know, I don't know how many groups out there protesting and so on and so forth, but one that we do see in every demonstration and march are those people, young, old, and so on, protesting on behalf of environmental issues, and in particular against fracking and things of that nature, exploitative, industries. I don't really know if the government of President Iván Duque has a coherent environmental plan, but you are better placed to tell us a little bit about this. I mean, what is the government really doing to, I don't know, mitigate climate change or protect what is Colombia's great strength, which is the diversity of the ecosystems here?
I mean, that definitely is Colombia's great strength, absolutely. And historically, not just Iván Duque's government, but pretty much all of our governments have not made the environment a priority. And Well, obviously, there was some expectation for this to change when the peace accords were signed. Especially, you know, we've always had low budgets for the environment, for natural parks, and so on. The politics have always been more focused on economic development and in spite of the environment, you could say.
At the expense of the environment.
At the expense of the environment, exactly. Mm. And Duque's government being so right-winged is especially more focused on these things. And they have been approving some really ridiculous things that shouldn't be happening, especially here. For example, fracking is very exploitative. We know it pollutes the underground waters and damages the environment significantly, but, you know, it will produce a profit. So there are a lot of these kind of things that are not thought in terms of sustainability, but just in terms of economic development and profit. The other major issue that people are fighting about right now is also the sprays with glyphosate. So you know, the Roundup to stop the coca crops. It was banned in the previous government, in Santos' government, once they showed that it was cancerogenous. Mm-hmm. And so Duque has been trying to bring it back in different ways. But the most important thing about this is that it hasn't been an effective drug control policy. And in the meantime, it pollutes the environment and it affects the community's health. Yeah. So this is another contention point that is going right now. And well, the latest one was they approved the commercialization of shark fins.
That's right.
Which is terrible.
Well, it seems there are three incredibly hot topics that you've addressed there. Of course, we talk fracking, which I know for a fact are going to come under review. I think it's probably a positive, not positive for us, but positive review for fracking. Well, they'll in places like, it's near San Alberto Cesar, Gamarra, all that zone, Gamarra Cesar. Mm-hmm. That's where the fracking projects have been sort of tested, and they'll go ahead. I mean, this government will push them through, but although it's a minority government, so maybe they'll be knocked back, but they seem to just want to get anything, as you say, economically beneficial to go ahead. And that, I mean, that one, it worries me because there's no mapping of the aquifers in Colombia.
Yes.
And they're saying that for exploratory reasons, they should do it, and they'll map the aquifers afterwards. But that's kind of like contradicting yourself. You know, you're going to pollute them and then say they're there.
Basically, and that's how it goes, for example, as well with a lot of mining projects, both legal and illegal, you know. So yeah, I mean, when you do such risky activities, you should take the precautionary approach and not just like jump into it like this.
Fracking, and the last one, I mean, the other one you said is glyphosate, the carcinogen,
the pesticide
that's put on the coca fields and then enters the food chain and then into the water system, and
it kills fish, it kills a lot of frogs, and when it first started, like 20 or 25 years ago, there was a spike in health complaints, and people claimed irritation in their skin and eyes and their stomach lining and some other stuff. And it was never properly reviewed in a way that there was never an unbiased review. And also there was never a study based in Colombia and like in the affected area. So most studies were done by foreign labs or using the product with its recommended guidelines. But that is not the way that it has been used here. With like protection equipment or anything, it's just been sprayed on campesinos in the by a huge plane, like a huge plane load of pesticide dropped on people who have no protection. So,
And of course, when we talk about that, like large numbers of indigenous communities in the in the wooded and isolated areas of Colombia, I mean, it's they're not dropping it on Parque El Virrey. They're not dropping it on the Parque Nacional.
No.
I worry because, you know, when we talk about the environment here in Colombia, they're obviously, what I'm so excited about is this young generation coming through. And as I'm now in my 40s, I can say young generation, people like you, but they're coming through with a real knowledge of environmental issues and a real knowledge of the need to protect what is here, the mega diverse environment and ecosystem in Colombia. And when we talk about those, I mean, we can list off all of the different areas of Colombia that are so very special to visit and very special to protect. And we've had a show, of course, before, but I don't know how many years back now, where we talked to scientists from the Rosario, and they're talking about sort of measuring and protecting the páramos. But tell us what you think about the páramos. And for our listeners, these are these high altitude plains, which, you know, only 50 kilometers south of Bogota, you know, is this amazing place called the Sumapaz National Park. And it's a páramo and it provides most of the water for Bogota. But it's so delicate. And of course, there's probably gold underneath it. What are your thoughts about the páramos?
I mean, yes, what you said is very important because they, their main service to us is as a water supply and as a water source, because the way the vegetation acts is basically as a sponge. So it absorbs all the rain that we get, and it lets it accumulate in a way that we could use it. So it's like if you drop water on a sponge, or if you drop it on a table or on a or something. So if you drop it on the sponge, you can then take it and use it. If you drop it on the table, it's just gone. You know? So if we lose the páramos, we would lose a lot of water, and not only drinking water, but also water for irrigation systems and for some hydroelectric plants. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the páramos is, like, as you said, they're very sensitive, especially to climate change. So the heating, the warming temperature rate in the Andes, especially above 2,000 meters over sea level, is twice as high as the global average. So they are very, very sensitive to this change. And since they occur, the páramos start showing up at like 3,000 meters, the most likely response they'll have is to move upward. So this will reduce their area significantly as you move up the mountain.
Mm. Well, because they run out of mountain as well.
They run out of mountain.
Exactly.
They're like the belt between they're the belt between the snow and the forest. Mm.
You get up there and it's just otherworldly, and especially with these frailejones, and I don't know how to translate it into English. But
No, me neither.
It's kind of like a prehistoric plant that's just there, and it's so
beautiful. They're very special plants because they are basically the only tall plants that there are in the páramo, because most of it's grass and shrubs. And the way the frailejones survive, I think it's really cool because they keep their old leaves attached to the trunk, and the decomposition process of the leaves is what keeps them warm and allows them to grow up, to grow upwards, I mean.
There's the biologist in you talking. You knew all
yes.
Fantastic. Now, one thing you mentioned there, and I thought was very interesting, is that the temperature of the páramos is increasing at a greater rate than, let's say, the global average.
Yes.
Wow. So they're really in trouble.
Yeah, they really are. And another big problem that we would have if páramos go away is that there are also a lot of, let's say, peats, you can say peats, like what you have in England, sort of.
Yeah.
And they accumulate a lot of carbon. So if they are threatened or burned down or something, they would release an amount of CO2 comparable to that of the recent Amazon fires. Mm. Because they have a very large cumulative capacity. So that would also be very bad.
Oh, dear. I mean, so we got those. And if we talk about a few other places in Colombia, because I know a lot of people tune into this podcast because of there's a travel element to it, so week in, week out. But I've only been to the Llanos a couple of times, but it's about the most spectacular as well. And, of course, the Caribbean mm-hmm. coast and the beaches and so on and so forth. But let's take them one by one. The Llanos, which are the savannas between before the Amazon. So we're looking mm-hmm. at kind of parts of Guaviare, Meta, Casanare, all of this area, which I would say is big sky country. You know, it's huge blue skies.
It's definitely big sky. Yeah.
But I mean, a couple of years ago, I had to write a few articles about the droughts taking place. Now, these droughts are they anomalies, or is it something to do with climatic, let's say, patterns like El Nino or La Nina? Or what can you relate to?
I mean, well, it is a bit of both, because there is a cyclic pattern. So we have a dry and a rainy season. Mm-hmm. But with El Nino and La Nina, what happens is that it intensifies. It intensifies the extremes. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you had like a 2 month drought, now it becomes like a 3 or 4 month drought, for example. These are not exact figures, but just to give you an idea. And so the peak of the dry season in Llanos is usually December to March. And it coincides with like the peak of the El Nino phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So like they both kind of act like in a synergistic way. So it gets really bad with the droughts in Los Llanos. Mm-hmm.
Is there any way that they can be protected? I mean, I have no idea, because I was there and it was very wet. I mean, at least the soil was very wet, and I can't imagine it so dry.
It gets very dry. I remember, I don't know, a few years back, maybe 3 or 4, where I saw this big picture in the newspaper, and it was a capybara carcass, where there was supposed to be a riverbed, and the riverbed was gone. So the capybara just went to where there was water, but there wasn't any water.
Mm. So the Llanos are at risk as well, and because they kind of stem out from the Piedmonte of the Andes. And
yes.
So I have my business interests in Mompós, and I think it was 2010 we suffered from El Nino. We could walk across the Magdalena River in front. It was so low and there was no water. And then La Nina followed straight afterwards, and I had to sandbag my house because the flooding. It was incredible. So you're saying then, as an environmentalist and an expert in this, that this is going to happen more often?
Yes, this is going to happen more often. So The El Nino and El Niña phenomenon have been really hard to predict and to study the response to climate change. But the most likely thing is that they will become more extreme, and they will increase in frequency. So El Niño happens a bit more frequently than La Niña. El Niño happens about every 9 to 12 months, and La Niña is like every 1 or 3 years. But with climate change, what is predicted is that there will be more La Niña events. And so there will be more of this massive floods, like you say. And especially if you consider traditionally drier areas like Mompós and César, Valledupar, the Caribbean, Atlántico, Magdalena, all of these places where they never have had to worry about these things. Obviously, when they do get floods, it is it is very chaotic because they don't know how to deal with this.
Well, we could do like they did in Montbos, was they took the Black Christ off the altar in the San Agustin Church and paraded down to the river to wash his feet. And then the waters reduced and they receded.
really? Oh my God, that's amazing.
It's happened twice. My wife's grandmother remembers it some 85 years ago, and then it happened in 2010. Okay. It's on YouTube if anyone's interested. Someone recorded it. We're in trouble then. A country with so many different regions, which are very, very delicate and, you know, are affected by even the most slight changes in temperature and frequency of La Niña or El Niño. We're in trouble here on the equator.
And Colombia is especially unpredictable, you know, because our geography in itself is just so diverse. So, like, I also remember a few years back, I think it was like 2011 or 12, where there was like a massive La Niña event and all of the Bogota plains just flooded, and it ruined like a bunch of crops, and then the water just like sort of sank in there, and it just smelled bad for ages.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah.
But so we'll see that more. So the people who've bought these, very expensive, and as we'd say here in Colombia, Strato 6 houses in the plains of like Nitochia and maybe Zipaquirá, all of these places flooded.
Yeah, they could be. They could be flooded
Let's move on then, on this happy note. Let's move on to the Caribbean coast, because you see somewhere like the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, and of course the environmental delicacy, again, to use the word, in that area with the single isolated or unique mountain range on a coastline. I mean, that's obviously, if the snow melts up on the Pico Bolivar and the, what's the other one called? Pico Colón, I want to say.
Pico Colón,
yeah,
yes.
There we go. Phew, thank God. If the snow melts up on those places, then we're, again, the environmental hangover or the environmental consequence to the Caribbean coast is going to be massive as well.
I mean, yes, of course. So in the way that páramos are like water providers here, all those snow caps, and there are páramos in Sierra Nevada as well. So, of course, there will be a similar problem with water supply. And especially because in the lowlands, it is, as I just mentioned, it is a bit more arid and dry than other parts of the country. So it's definitely a problem. So my parents like to go on vacation to Santa Marta very often. And like when you go in dry season, the staff has mentioned like we had to bring water in like big car tanks because there is no water right now, and there is a very limited water, and it's a struggle. And it's a struggle, especially for the local people, not so much for the big hotels, the fancy hotels and buildings and stuff, but for the local community, it has become more difficult. And again, it has become more frequent as well.
But how are we going to, I mean, how will they resolve this? Because it will end up becoming a problem for the big hotels too.
Yes. I don't know. I think the government really needs to take charge of the situation. So another interesting case, of course, is Palomino. Right now, a lot of people are like aware that Palomino is in trouble and will be in more trouble because of the sudden boom in tourism, which is good. I mean, it's good. It is bringing income to the community, to the country, but it, with being so unexpected, they were not ready for it. So Palomino was a very isolated town. They still don't have a proper sewage system or an aqueduct, and they have intermittent electric power, and they just have some poorly designed septic tanks that have already begun polluting aquifers. And then, you know, as well, a lot of the tourism in the area is informal. It's not registered, so they're not paying taxes. So a lot of the profit that they are generating will not be used to build this infrastructure that they need.
You know, we talk about tourism and we talk about all these things, and obviously tourism is a trickle-down economy and it does benefit a lot of people, but it does need to be kept in check, especially in places like Palomino. I think it's become, it seems to have, I mean, there are some luxury places and there are some mid-range places, but of course it's also sucked a great number of let's say the occupants of backpacker hostels in Taganga have gone up there. I think it's the best way of putting it.
Changed
immensely.
Yeah, and Taganga, and for example, El Rodadero are a bit of a cautionary tale because, you know, Taganga used to be like pretty much just as beautiful as Palomino, but now there's like a really negative party culture, and there's like drugs and child prostitution and a lot of environmental destruction. So we don't want that to happen. For example, I remember my parents telling me they went to El Rodadero as kids with their family on vacation, and the beaches were white and it was nice. And that's not the Rodadero I know,
And you weren't being bothered by ceviche vendors and...
No. And vendors of every such everything. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Everything.
This is true. But at least it's still calmer than going to the beach, which is, they're not beaches, the ones in Cartagena. They're not worth going to, but the ones in Santa Marta are still a little bit nicer. But I mean, you know, in a perfect world, let's say you've got your master's now in science communication, you have your degree in biology. In a perfect world, where do you see yourself working now? Here, are you going to leave Colombia again, or are you going to put your efforts into trying to, I don't know, help businesses or help communicate the issues at stake here in Colombia?
I would definitely like to do that, but right now for me it has been very difficult to find a paid position in Colombia. There are very few openings, and it's been hard. And I know people who have really successful science communication projects going in Colombia. Like, I don't know if you've heard about Ciencia Café Paso Merced or Shots de Ciencia, and they're doing really amazing things. But I know both of the people behind these projects, and they're still not making their living from that. So that is a bit challenging for me. But definitely, I think I see my role as communicating these things, because it is important for people to know this. I know even like very educated people who have like postgraduate degrees and many of these things still are not aware of many of these issues. And of course the general public even less so.
Yeah.
I think a big obstacle for focusing on these issues in Colombia is that a lot of people live from day to day, you know, from the most immediate concerns.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. You just, you know, there's such a level of have and have nots. And when you think of people just needing to provide to feed their families and to provide for them.
Yes, exactly.
It's tough. But to try and explain that, well, you know, instead of, you know, harvesting all the Ikotea turtles, you know, for food this Easter, perhaps don't do it because there won't be any next Easter. You know, it's a kind of the equivalent in the iguana eggs or farming on precious lands and so on. So you could become maybe the science and nature correspondent for one of the newspapers or magazines.
I need to look around a bit more to see what I can find. But it's definitely worth trying, because I just A factor that influenced my decision of going into science communication was that I know basic research in science is important and is very useful, but I felt it was very limited to its own world. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it's more urgent to communicate these things and to talk about these things.
Well, it's, you know, and you take your biology, your degree in biology, and you talk to us, you know, like someone like me who's no expert in any of this, and you, by being a communicator, by knowing how to present these things, you can then deliver it to us in a way that's manageable and understandable. These things are important. While I'm saying that, have you looked into Semana Rural?
No, not Semana Rural particularly. I have looked into Semana Sostenible. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or is that what you meant?
Yeah, but that's the newspaper, I think.
I know there's Semana. Both. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great.
But it's not all bad news, you know. No. I think it's important to be aware of the main... A very important thing is to empower local communities to take charge of what they have, you know. And I think a really good example of this is Nuquí.
Yeah.
Nuquí in the Pacific Coast, I think, is doing great with this.
Fantastic. So what are they doing in Nuquí? Because I haven't been in Nuquí since 2007, I want to say.
Yes, well, So in Nuquí, the tourism sort of culture and thinking is very community-based. So there is an exchange of trades and services. So, for example, if you go to this hotel, the lady who knows how to cook will cook, and the other ones will help with the cleaning, and the person who knows how to go on the trekking hill, on the trekking paths, will take you. And then there's the guy who owns a boat who will take you go whale watching. So there's like this tight-knit community where they help each other out. Like, I have a tourist who wants to do this. And so they are organized in a way where they take care of every step of the process, and they just provide work for everyone in this way, you know. And you know, they wanted to build the Tribuga port over there, and the community has made it very clear that they don't want that. And they have been very vocal about that. And, you know, I think that's really good, the way the community thinking has led them to work together and to protect what they have there. And, you know, recognize that is their richness.
Yeah, definitely. I think an empowerment of the communities. I think in somewhere like Nuquí, it's obviously... It's possible. We have to, unfortunately, wind down the show. But in other parts of the country, maybe where there's, let's say, valuable resources underground, you know, the empowerment of the local communities sometimes comes at a very great risk to those local communities.
Yes. But I think in any decision making, this should be considered the community's point of view, and the community empowerment should be like a focus of that, especially if we want to build sustainable practices.
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, I'd like to take this moment to say thank you so much for taking your time to share a little bit of your vast knowledge, and it really is. You can tell we've only scraped the surface here on, of course, your homeland of Colombia, and putting it into an international context with regards to environmental issues and what's going on here. There's a lot to be done, but as you said, we're ending on a positive note that there are things that have been done, and we should continue in that vein. Perhaps, I think, you know, what we're getting at there is maybe it's not working against the government, but work around it a little bit and just sort of, yeah, maybe these isolated communities.
Mean, yeah, well, sometimes you do have to work against it, but yeah, there's a lot of it is working around it. A lot of it is NGOs and foundations and charities and people who decide to take charge because the government isn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this government and previous governments and have all been more interested in the economic rewards, immediate economic rewards, let's say, rather than the long-term economic rewards of. But anyway, let's see, listen. Thank you so much, Juliana, for your time and for sharing information like this with us. I wish you all the best in your search for, let's say, a meaningful and reasonably well-paying job in this field. I'm sure there are options for you because there can't be that many science, well, I don't know, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, science communicators with a proper biology background out there here in Colombia. So I'm hoping. And if anyone out there is listening and, you know, knows of an opening for Juliana, there she is, she's there. So get in touch with us or get in touch with her directly. Because, Juliana Cucaro, you'll find her name. And help her out because we're all here to help one another. I definitely believe that. So thank you again, Juliana, for your time today.
No, thank you. I appreciate it a lot. It's been fun. I've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
Well, of course, and my listeners will definitely love it. And so, Wes, that's us, Colombia Calling, signing off for the year 2019 with episode 305. Thank you for making this year a particularly special one for the Colombia Calling podcast. Our numbers have increased dramatically, not only on the back of great interviews, but of course you guys are tuning in and spreading the word. So this is a great big Christmas and New Year hug to all of you out there. Thank you again. And we'll be back in early January with more interesting people, and we'll continue to produce podcast episodes every week with fascinating people doing great things for or about Colombia. So thank you again. That's me, Richard McColl, signing off for 2019. Bye-bye.
Habla con la playa, no tiene por otro.